Good evening. It's a pleasure to welcome you all to this professorial lecture, and a particular pleasure to welcome so many of you to this lecture. It's pleasing to see the room almost full. And I'm sure you've been attracted by a combination of the high reputation of the lecturer and the high importance of the topic that he's going to cover. Richard Black started his career as a student in Oxford, went on to do his doctorate in London, where he started his research career looking at rural change in northern Portugal, if I remember right. And then became a lecturer at King's College London, moved to Sussex in 1995. In his research career, he has specialised in refugee studies and the study of migration, and has made a very considerable reputation for himself with a steady stream of immensely well-regarded academic articles. And a number of books. The number was three the last time I looked at it, but who knows, it's probably gone up since then. But Richard Black's work is important not just because it is work of very high academic quality, but because it's work of very high academic quality addressed to a very important set of issues. I also want to say, in introducing Richard, that his work, his career, has another very important characteristic, which is not just focused on research for its own sake, or research because the topic is important. He has built very strong links between his own research interests and his own research development, and the building of institutions. He has made very important contributions to the development of graduate studies in Sussex. Of course, the MA in Migration Studies, but also an important period as the director for the Centre for Cultural Development and Environment. And now, as you see at the top right-hand side of the screen behind me, the Development Research Centre in Migration, Globalisation and Poverty, a major research centre funded by UCIF Launch and now directed by Richard Black. So these very important links between the quality of academic research, the application of high quality research to issues of crucial importance to our society, the building of institutions within Sussex, the building of links of important links with other institutions in the country and in other countries, and the building of strong graduate programs around a strong research base. This is all an immensely impressive career, which is still in various stages. So I'm looking forward, and I know you all are, to hearing this professorial lecture on migrants, refugees, and public policy, and to hearing a sample of what Richard offers. So, Richard Black.
First of all, thank you all for coming, and I hope I can live up to those very kind words. Migrants and refugees today are reviled and pitied in equal measure. Here in the UK, we don't have to spend too long reading the newspaper to see how immigrants, and especially asylum seeker, have become almost terms of abuse. The threat that they pose is articulated in a number of different ways. First, maybe as a security threat, particularly after 9/11. Especially when associated with radical brands of Islam, but also in the sense that so-called illegal migration is seen as somehow out of control. Certainly a threat to our welfare state, the most common form of panic articulated in our newspapers about migrants is that of the migrant or asylum seeker helping themselves to public housing and public benefits, although there are also many other much more ridiculous stories circulating in the press. Also, from time to time, immigrants are seen as a threat to the economy and to jobs. Although, interestingly, this hasn't been such a prominent discourse in the UK in recent years, and I think we can learn a little from that. Even though there clearly are many migrants being paid at below the minimum wage, in conditions that do not meet standards of decency and safety, public fears of cheap foreign labour undermining local jobs and labour standards have been muted, to say the least. So reviled, yes, but migrants and refugees are also pitied, especially if we consider the issue on a global scale. Here there are two discourses, the refugee as victim and the migrant as the victim of trafficking. The archetypal refugee, usually a woman or a child, and we're often told that 80% of refugees apparently are women and children, has been painted as African, probably starving, and wholly dependent on the international community in the form of Western aid agencies or the UN to come to the rescue. In turn, migrants are victims of unscrupulous traffickers. Here it is women and children too who are often the subject of concern. It may be okay for men to migrate, perhaps they're the ones who constitute the threat, but women and children are certainly ripe for exploitation, caught in networks of prostitution and bonded labour, and needing again the intervention of international anti-trafficking agencies to rescue them and return them to their home communities. Whatever, certainly refugees and migrants are not like us. Indeed, when US network television referred to those fleeing Hurricane Katrina as refugees, protests came not from academics concerned to maintain a precise distinction between refugee and migrant in international law or social science theory, but from Jesse Jackson and George W. Bush, the former saying during a visit to the Houston Astrodome that it is racist to call American citizens refugees. And the latter chiming in with, the people we're talking about are not refugees, they are Americans. So refugees as victim, migrants as threat, an age-old reaction to those that society sees as different. But also, and it pains me to be on the same side of an argument as George Bush, a different picture emerges when those people are closer to us, when we can understand their situation and plan with them a way to respond to displacement. Then victims are not refugees, they are Americans, and most of all, they are people. Over the past decade, it's been my privilege to be part of a centre that has pioneered a different, and I believe in many ways a new way of thinking about what it is to be a migrant, or indeed a refugee. One that privileges their role as people, actively making choices about their lives. Soon after I arrived at Sussex, I attended my first Sussex professorial lecture in which Russell King talked not of the migration problem, but of a celebration of migration. And that in many respects has been what our centre, that we co-founded in 1997 and which has flourished since then, has been all about. In this story, migrants and refugees are not just victims or a threat to society, but are people with a capacity to change their own lives and society for the better. They are, for example, the musicians, artists and writers who have transformed our cultural life and have been the focus of workshops here on music and migration and migrant cinema. And this, by the way, was the ending concert for a conference we recently held in Dhaka with a Bangladeshi migrant musician who'd just returned from London. They're also the restaurant owners and workers who've transformed our national cuisine, who form the core of the cooks and kitchen staff here in Brighton and Hove, and who Evgenia Markova and her team of researchers are currently interviewing as part of a new study on European immigration in Britain from countries like Albania, Bulgaria and the Ukraine. Unless we fall into the trap that migrants and refugees can't be British, there are also British retirees in Spain, Italy and Malta, studied by Russell, or the 10-pound Poms who went to Australia under assisted passage schemes in the 1950s, and whose fascinating life stories have been collected by Al Thompson. I'm not sure if he's here, but anyway, Al, interesting work. For that matter, they're also Americans. As the recent IPPR study Beyond Black and White shows, there are 155,000 Americans in Britain, more than there are people from Bangladesh, and the fifth largest country of origin of foreign-born populations in the UK today. And some of you will know that I have a personal reason for being happy about Americans being here. So migrants are not just the poor and the needy swept up by events beyond their control, in turn posing a problem for public policy and the wider society. They're also actors capable of influencing outcomes for themselves and for others. Now, of course, what I said in these introductory remarks are in many ways caricatures, stereotypes as well, rather than academic or policy descriptions of refugees and migrants. Although the power of these stereotypes is strong. In practice, though, refugees and migrants are neither good nor bad. Indeed, migration, even forced migration, is neither good nor bad. Nonetheless, I think it is good and worthy of note that over the last decade, there has been something of a shift in thinking about migrants, and to a lesser extent refugees, in government and to a certain extent in public discourse. For example, the UK government, in its consultation paper on a strategy for making migration work for Britain, and the consultation ends on the 7th of November, by the way, so there's still time to participate in that, they say that migration makes a substantial contribution to economic growth, helps fill gaps in the labour market, including key public services, such as health and education, and increases investment, innovation and entrepreneurship in the UK. Similarly, a recent European Union communication on migration and development, published last month, says that countries and international organisations increasingly perceive migration as a phenomenon whose positive impacts in development terms can be substantial. And the Global Commission on International Migration, which reported last week in New York, has said that the role migrants play in promoting development and poverty reduction in countries of origin, as well as the contribution they make towards the prosperity of destination countries, should be recognised and reinforced. Now, these are not people stories, but they are at least positive stories. Indeed, there are more. For example, as a result of more accurate counting by the IMF and central banks around the world, we now know that there is something in the region of $100 million sent every year by migrant workers to their countries of origin in the developing world, and that's about double the total of international aid sent each year by rich countries. Or, for example, as a result of research supported by our Development Research Centre, conducted by Alan Winters, Terry Walmsley, Ron Skelton and Chris Parsons, we now have new estimates that suggest that a 3% rise in temporary mobility around the world could result in gains of up to billion US dollars each year, and that fairly evenly distributed between rich and poor nations. But there is, of course, a negative side to migration too. For example, Wayne Cornelius and Douglas Massey in the US have studied movements across the Mexican-American border, showing over 300 migrants dying each year from exposure or dehydration trying to get into the US. And the No Border Network in Europe has recorded 1,205 deaths of migrants trying to enter Europe across the Mediterranean since it started monitoring news stories just 3 years ago in 2002. So in this context, how then are we to view migration and refugee flows, processes that produce such varied outcomes? Well, I want to make three essential points in this lecture. The first, I want to talk a little bit about how many migrants and refugees there actually are in the world, because I think there are often a lot of misconceptions on this. Second, I want to concentrate on what I see as some of the research and policy challenges, or put another way, what are the aspects of migration that matter in terms of economic and social outcomes. I think here it's easy to get carried away with assumptions about migrants or refugees as a threat, or what I see as rather fanciful arguments about migrants threatening the notion of Britishness. Instead, I want to try and focus on what we know or could know about migration that could enhance these social and economic outcomes, especially for poor people. What do we know or could we know that might help to maximise the benefits of migration whilst minimising its risks and costs? And then thirdly, I want to spend a little bit of time at the end thinking about the differences between migrants and refugees. I've chosen to deal with them both together here. Is that the right thing to do? So first of all, how many migrants and refugees are there? This is a simple point, really, or at least it should be. Over the last year, Chris Parsons, who's not here today, working with Ron Skelton, has been putting together a definitive database of country-to-country movements based on stocks of foreign-born population in each of the 226 countries recognised by the UN around the world. And this work, which is due to be published in December, suggests a global total of foreign-born of 176 million. Close to previous UN estimates, although a recent UNFPA figure quoted by the Global Commission report last week puts the figure at 200 million. Of these, 9 million are refugees. Okay, that's fine, but there are a number of problems with these statistics. First, there is the issue of how a migrant is defined. In our case, and in the case of the UNFPA figures, what we're actually measuring are people currently living outside their country of birth who've been there for at least a year. Of course, that includes some who we might not intuitively think of as migrants, and also excludes others. For example, of those 176 to 200 million, a large proportion of the 13 million who are living in Russia, or the 7 million who are living in Ukraine, would have been internal migrants before the fall of the Soviet Union, and indeed probably themselves, many of them never actually crossed an international border because at the time they migrated it didn't exist. Or in turn, many other international migrant populations by this definition are historical. People who happen to live outside their country of birth but moved there many years ago. For example, in India, Pakistan and Bangladesh, people who moved at partition in the 1940s. Or Ugandan and Kenyan Asians, white British or Portuguese, who left Africa immediately after independence. It's quite interesting to see that amongst the top five countries of African migration to Europe, by our figures, are Kenya and Angola, not countries, I assure you, that are sending very large amounts of migrants at the present moment. Yet what are excluded from these figures, of course, are the second generation of migrant families, many of whom may still not have the citizenship of the country that they've moved to. And in addition, what's missing are internal migrants, people who happen to live in very large states and have moved perhaps as long distances as many international migrants, but have not crossed an international border. The second point about these figures is that in quoting the figure of 200 million migrants, the Global Commission on International Migration said, and I quote, "This shows an increase in the scale and scope of international migration to a number equivalent to the fifth most populous country on earth, Brazil, more than double the figure recorded in 1980 and only 25 years ago." And of course they say this as a way of establishing that migration is an important subject to look at and, you know, a reason for having a global report from the UN. But the metaphor conjures up this image of all of those 200 million migrants all being in one place, all arriving in Britain at the same time, for example, and representing a huge problem, which they're not. In fact, even if the migrant population has doubled since 1980, the world's population, of course, has also risen from 4.4 to 6 billion. So the total number of international migrants to the world is still only around 3% of the world's population. And with thanks to Saskia Gent in our centre, I now know that's about the same proportion as the number of Britons who are members of political parties, or the proportion of people in the world with psoriasis or who take illegal drugs. And as I say, it's important to note that these figures crucially miss internal migration. The figures would certainly double, perhaps treble, if internal migrants between states in India or within China or indeed between states in the US were included. So it all depends on how we define migration, and we really need to be careful about banding about figures about migration as if somehow this justifies the importance of the topic. This is really a migration watch approach to the topic rather than an academic approach. And incidentally, on the matter of numbers, it's actually 75% of the world's refugees who are women and children, only slightly higher than 70% of the world's population as a whole who are women and children. And if we bear in mind that developing countries generally have younger populations than developed countries, we can see that the age-sex breakdown of refugee populations is actually not that different to the average population in the developing world. And also, why exactly do people quote a figure of women and children as if in some way they had the same concerns or somehow were equally vulnerable? So that's all I've got to say about numbers. Moving on to what matters for the reduction of poverty. The first thing to say is that if our real concern is with the reduction of poverty, the type of migration that we ought to be most interested in is internal migration, over shorter distances, often for shorter duration, since that's the kind of migration that is most usually accessible to the poor. This is reflected in the focus of a number of studies in our Development Research Centre, where not only have we dealt with internal migration, but also with some of the least visible forms of migration. The seasonal movement of agricultural workers from one rural area to another, who are often the poorest of the poor. The replacement migration of poor Sylhetis in Bangladesh, who moved to the so-called Londoni villages that migrants have moved out to London from, which Katie is studying, Katie Gardner. Or the autonomous migration of children, who indeed are very much reviled and pitied by different groups of policymakers concerned with the situation of street children, but all too often are not asked their own views, nor credited with the ability to have livelihood strategies, or to be able to make decisions about their own future. All of these migrations are incredibly important, but I'm not going to focus on them today, first of all because I'm not so directly involved in this work myself, but also because as a UK-based audience, I'm guessing you'll be more interested in aspects of international migration that touch on the UK. So, if our focus is international migration, what are the things that matter in terms of outcomes? And I think there are three key areas of concern, or at least three areas of concern that I want to focus on today. First of all, remittances. Secondly, the so-called brain drain issue. And thirdly, the issue of temporary mobility. First, remittances. I've already said that there are perhaps 100 billion US dollars in workers' remittances sent each year to poorer countries, representing what the IMF calls a stable and growing form of development finance. Although we do need to sound a note of caution here, because of course these are private transfers from individuals to individuals and not necessarily substitutable for development aid or other forms of public investment. Nonetheless, these are significant sums, and I suspect that the figures on this that have been produced by people like Philip Rother at the World Bank have been more important than any other data or evidence in persuading governments about the positive side of migration. So what can we contribute to this debate? Well, some centres in the UK have been doing important work on measuring remittances. So we now know, for example, that about 2 to 3 billion US dollars is sent home by migrant workers in the UK alone, thanks to work at the University of East Anglia. Or DFID itself has targeted the high costs that migrant workers often have to pay to send money. Something that's particularly important for poorer migrants, that they're likely to send smaller sums on which the marginal cost of sending the money can often be as high as 15 or 20%. Bearing down on these high charges is not easy, but there are ways forward, and DFID is doing very important work on this, not least in addressing the monopolistic practices of some of the larger money transfer agencies like Western Union and MoneyGram, where it's not unusual for an international money transfer company to have an exclusive agreement with a national post office or other service that itself is perhaps the only network that reaches into rural areas where poor migrants' families come from. Now, our work on remittances has in fact been somewhat limited, but it does interestingly unite one of my first and one of my most recent writing projects, so I do want to say something about it. In the context of my own PhD work in northern Portugal, I looked at the way in which short, medium and long-term migration to France, Germany and Switzerland affected poverty and well-being in rural areas, in the mountains in the north of Portugal. Certainly I've been hunting for some slides or images of northern Portugal and I can't find them anywhere in my slide collection, so we'll have to stick with the image of MoneyGram for a while. Here in northern Portugal, remittances arguably impacted less on poverty than the rise in real wages for those who were left behind, and especially the wages of women that came from a contraction in the size of the agricultural labour force. Nonetheless, there was there a significant group, particularly of medium-term migrants, who used remittances and savings to invest in agricultural production and promote some measure of modernisation. Incidentally, migrants also invested in the property market, leading to very significant property price inflation, and I think this is a common feature that we see in many migrant-sending areas. Similarly, in the context of a recent project in Ghana and Cote d'Ivoire, where we focused on, at least in part, on what motivates people to send money in the first place, as well as how that money is used. In a joint paper with Richmond Timoko, who's here, and Claire Waddington, who isn't, which hopefully will shortly be published by the World Bank, we draw on over 600 interviews with return migrants who were asked about their remittance practices whilst they were abroad. And this again allows us to identify groups of migrants with particular kinds of remitting behaviour. For example, amongst them, our sample was divided into more skilled and less skilled groups. Those from poorer backgrounds who were already married before they went abroad to work and stayed abroad longer, more than 5 years in our measure, tended to be the most likely to remit, and the most likely to remit more frequently. Amongst this group in particular, but also more generally, Migrants and returnees spoke of the obligation they felt to send money to their relatives, especially where the family had assisted them to migrate. So we have a kind of set of intergenerational and interfamily contracts going on that set up rights and obligations between migrants and their families. Nonetheless, the total amount that this group were able to send was still lower than those from richer households who were unmarried at the time of migration and did not go abroad primarily to work, but rather to study or join family members abroad. This suggests that there may be a particular group of potential migrants who are moving abroad with a wealth accumulation strategy, linked in this case to some kind of intergenerational contract with elder relatives. However, this has not necessarily allowed this group to catch up in terms of income or savings with more wealthy migrants who remit less frequently. And trying to think about how policy could increase the beneficial impact of remittances on poverty and inequality, one thing we did was to use a stepwise regression model to analyse the different effects of variables according to the stage of the migration process. And from this, we were able to understand that the potential contribution of different phases of migration, to the generation of remittances. Here, it appears that the experience of migrants before departure and in their first few years abroad may be the most important in influencing the level of remittances, suggesting in turn that policy interventions might be targeted at potential migrants and newly arriving immigrants rather than at those who've lived abroad for some time, where the level of remittances often evens off or indeed even declines. It's also worth noting, although in some ways challenging in terms of public policy, that in terms of the experiences that people had abroad, it was the job that was undertaken and the extent to which migrants maintained a level of contact with their families back home that were found to be more important in influencing remittances than factors such as education or indeed crucially integration in the host society, which made relatively little difference. Now, of course, some caveats to this work need to be made. First of all, the sample we used represented a relatively well-educated and probably fairly wealthy subset of Ghanaian and Ivorian populations overall, although even so, I think that the less skilled data set does reflect the pattern of immigration from Ghana and Cote d'Ivoire, which is largely still open only to the slightly more wealthy. And secondly, although some of those interviewed reported that they had travelled to Europe or North America illegally, information on legal status was not consistently recorded in this work, so it's not possible to draw conclusions on the significance of secure legal status abroad for the sending of remittances, and that is one hypothesis that I am very interested in as following up, and indeed Rachel Sabatis-Wheeler at IDS is planning to do or is doing within our centre. Now my second point relates to brain drain, or as we're preferring to call it in the centre, the mobility of skilled professionals. I'll say much less about this is work that is being led by Ron Skelton, and he still has to do his own professorial lecture. However, I think our contribution here has been far less in quantifying and explaining the mobility that's taken place, although it certainly is significant, with perhaps 60% of Ghana's doctors going abroad, but much more about approach. Put simply, a common approach to brain drain issues is to do effectively what I've just done with this slide: add up the number of people who've been trained, calculate all those who've migrated, and consider those as a loss to the country from which they've come, which in turn might be compensated in some way by payments from the rich world, according to some commentators. Indeed, we've also recently done a study of trainee doctors and nurses in Ghana, which shows that 2/3 of our sample had firm plans to migrate at the end of their training. However, this approach begs a lot of questions, and it's on these other questions that we're trying to focus our attention in the centre. For example, the number of people being trained in Ghana and elsewhere is not a given, it's a choice. Ghana might have a shortage of doctors, not because they all migrate, but because it just doesn't train enough. And in fact, Ghana trains a very, very small number of doctors. Alternatively, the doctors or nurses or other professionals don't belong in an unproblematic way to the country of origin. Indeed, insofar as they have been trained at the expense of the country of origin and hence represent a loss to public investment if they go abroad, this in itself is a choice of the government to publicly fund the training of doctors. And whilst I'm not necessarily advocating the withdrawal of public funding for university-level training of doctors in Ghana or anywhere else, we do need to recognise that poor countries have choices about what they spend scarce public money on, and that the choice to spend money on training doctors is a choice that leads to money being spent on one of the wealthiest sectors of the Ghanaian population. For example, again, our survey of trainee doctors shows that a staggering 70% of Ghana's trainee doctors are sons or daughters of other doctors from the Accra region. Third, we shouldn't assume that all Ghanaian doctors have been trained in Ghana. As not only is there increasing interest in training abroad, either at rich countries' public expense or more likely through private investment, but also the overseas training may in fact be essential for the doctor concerned to work abroad, and that goes for professionals from all African countries. If a Ghanaian professional completes their training abroad at their own expense and then stays there, in what sense can we call this a brain drain? Now, I know, of course, in some respects we can call it a brain drain, but it's not quite the same as the initial public rhetoric would suggest. And indeed, another point, with the survey that we've done of Ghanaian doctors and nurses and pensions, the highest ranked reason that people gave for why they planned to leave Ghana after training was indeed to get more training. And also, the loss of skills itself may happen less at the point at which the professional goes abroad, but much earlier, when for reasons of lack of investment in infrastructure or poor organisation, that person's skills cannot be used properly, if at all, in the country of origin. A doctor is of little use without medicines, a surgeon of little use without an operating table. Now, so far, these are mostly questions to which we have imperfect answers, although the interesting way forward, I think, is trying to think about outcomes if we start not from the principle of trying to keep doctors or nurses or other professionals in their home countries, but of allowing them to participate in a globalised labour market with fewer barriers and all the benefits that this undoubtedly brings to individuals. Can we shape or regulate a globalised labour market for skilled professionals in a way that poor developing countries do benefit? Are there differences between countries that can benefit from exporting their skilled personnel, and the Philippines is often held up as an example of this, and others who cannot? I cite, for example, the case of small island states in the Pacific as ones that are particularly vulnerable to the loss of skilled professionals. And if there are countries for whom the loss of skilled professionals is problematic, is there something we can do about it beyond simply banning recruitment, as the current NHS code of practice has, which effectively, if it were properly implemented, would condemn professionals from those countries to not being able to expand their own professional careers, at least in the UK. That leads me on to my third point on temporary migration, or if you prefer, the return of migrants. This is one of the more controversial proposals of the Global Commission. The government should consider establishing a series of carefully designed temporary migration programmes as a means of addressing the economic needs of both countries of origin and destination. And indeed, a move towards thinking about temporary migration, I think, is also in many ways implicit in the academic trend towards the study of transnationalism rather than migration. Now, of course, the idea of temporary migration programmes is not new. Through much of the 1960s and 1970s, European countries operated large-scale temporary migration programmes such as the Gastarbeiter schemes in Germany. While George W. Bush, and that man comes up again, is currently promoting temporary migration schemes to bring Mexican agricultural labour to the US to replace the long-standing Bracero schemes. Nor is the idea of temporary migration a long way from the UK government's thinking. Indeed, in its current consultation document, temporary migration is tier three. Although I have to say the government seems to rather hope that it won't need this tier three, and the demand for unskilled workers will be met from EU accession countries, something which I personally doubt. Now, the mention of George Bush again and the German Gastarbeiter programme will no doubt have rung alarm bells for many of you, as will the fact that for some time European governments have been trying to move towards a situation in which asylum, if it is given at all, is also given on a temporary basis only. Meanwhile, for those on the right, any mention of promoting temporary migration might itself be seen as a non-starter because it involves promoting migration. But I reckon that the proposal that we should have more temporary mobility does deserve careful consideration, not least because in the context of Alan Winter's and Terry Walmsley's calculations that I mentioned earlier, it is something that could potentially have huge economic benefits. Furthermore, many international migrants and refugees actually do want to return to their countries of origin, to build a house, to invest in a business, or simply to spend their money in a place where sterling or euros or dollars go much further. I think this demands that we should look seriously at temporary migration and return, and not simply dismiss it as something that only nationalists or racists would advocate. However, one problem with the debate on temporary migration so far is that it has tended to be framed only in the context of UK labour market needs, rather and rarely in the context of global poverty. Indeed, work on temporary migration schemes in organisations such as the World Bank have so far focused only on how to ensure that temporary workers return, rather than ensuring that their migration is successful in broader ways. Another key problem is the focus on designing schemes in order to control outcomes, rather than putting the emphasis on temporary mobility as liberalisation. Now here I want to mention four areas of policy leverage that have emerged from discussions we've initiated here at Sussex that might help to make temporary migration perhaps a little bit more development friendly. First, for temporary labour migration, it matters how people are recruited. One way for this to be done is by bilateral agreement between governments based on an analysis of labour market needs. The alternative that seems to be preferred by our current government talks of accredited operators, private sector operators, who will recruit from certain countries and be responsible for the welfare and return of those migrants. But history is littered with both abusive private operators and also with corrupt official schemes. I would argue that what's more important is less whether the migration is on the basis of public or private recruitment, but more how transparent and open the system is to potential migrants. Secondly, just because a job is temporary doesn't mean that the worker should lack rights. Indeed, this is perhaps the biggest fear for those on the left, that temporary labour migration means lower wages, poorer working conditions, watered down rights. This is important not only because it threatens the well-being of workers more generally, but also from a development point of view, because the conditions under which refugees and migrants work impact on how much they manage to contribute to their country's origin. If temporary labour migration schemes are to be expanded, I would argue that employers need to be held to account if they do not implement fair and safe employment practices. Yet this requires more than relying on migrants to file complaints against banned employers, because those on short-term contracts may well have left the country by the time their cases get to employment tribunals. Indeed, I think what we should be thinking about is how our labour rights regimes more generally, the minimum wage, health and safety legislation and so on, can be adapted to take into account the reality of temporariness and flux in the labour market. Third, the success of a temporary labour migration scheme from the point of view of global poverty clearly depends on the ability of migrants to transfer money. This is one of the major benefits of migration. And refugees and those with temporary protection may also send significant remittances. Here a number of initiatives are needed, and I've mentioned some of them already. I think we also need to bear in mind issues such as the ability to transfer social security and pension benefits to home countries. This is arguably more important than simply maximising the flows of remittances, since of course sending higher amounts of remittances, and our government is I think worryingly at the moment talking about compulsory remittances on temporary migration schemes, may of course put migrants themselves in a very precarious economic state in the UK. And finally, there's the issue of return. Although integral to the idea of temporary migration, I think it's important that we don't get hung up on the issue of return. First of all, because return itself may be temporary. The temporary migrants may well come back again, and we shouldn't be scared about that. Some successful temporary migration schemes have involved people coming and going over a long period of time, and they seem to be often quite well received by migrants. Secondly, because left to their own devices, many migrants do return. A lot is said about the Gastarbeiter never returning, but we heard in our migration seminar last week that a third of them did. Indeed, return is a process that remains largely unreported, of course, because it is also quite uncontroversial for governments. But most importantly, whatever incentives or rules you write into a migration programme, our research on return suggests that the single most influential factor about whether a return is successful or not is the macroeconomic and political climate of the country of origin that somebody comes from. Essentially, if they come from a country in which, you know, somebody can see a future for themselves in returning, people will return, and if they can't, they won't. And incidentally, the second most important factor is family circumstances. A very large number of people who return do so on the death of a parent or at the point at which elderly relatives need taking care of, and these are the things that really it's very difficult to write into a scheme. So I would argue that in this respect, the Global Commission on International Migration, and indeed the government's current consultation, have opened up a debate on expanding migration, even if it is temporary, that is long overdue. But promoting temporary mobility will be no use if we replace one set of draconian immigration rules with another focused on the rules for a migration programme. And we also need to make sure that this debate includes the voices of migrants and developing countries if it's to achieve the impact it deserves. Now, so far in this lecture, I've treated migrants and refugees as if they are comparable, although in line with the concerns of the Development Research Centre on Migration and Globalisation of Poverty, I've prioritised somewhat the discussion of economic migration. But should we do this? Should we have a centre or a research project that focuses both on migrants and refugees? Is there a justification for researching what some people have called the migration-asylum nexus? Alternatively, is there a justification for extending the definition of a refugee somehow to encompass all forced migrants? Or is the real distinction between forced and voluntary migrants, not between migrants and refugees? Is there a justification for new categories of refugee, economic refugees, environmental migrants, environmental refugees even? Now, many of you will know that I have quite a few views on these matters. Perhaps the fairest way of putting this is to say that there are similarities and differences between migrants and refugees, and whether it's sensible to make a distinction depends on the context. But really, this is quite a lame statement, and I think we can do better than that. What I'd rather say is that from an analytical point of view, the distinction between a migrant and a refugee is often not helpful. But from a policy point of view, there are some good reasons, both fundamental and instrumental, for maintaining a distinction, and indeed, I would argue, for maintaining pretty much the definitions that are currently within UK and international law. On the analytical side, I see few things that genuinely distinguish migrants and refugees. I take as one example a small piece of research we did for the Home Office a couple of years ago in three of the UK's immigration detention centres. Our intention and mandate here from the Home Office was to study those who had lived illegally in the UK and not to study detainees who were simply failed asylum seekers who'd been locked up awaiting deportation. But even so, we found that something like two-thirds of our sample had claimed asylum at one stage. Now, you might say that this reflects what the government says is abuse of the asylum system, that these are people who were not really refugees but were trying to claim the status because it would have allowed them to stay. Yet at the same time, nearly half of those who cited a reason for leaving their home country mentioned a lack of safety, including reports of threats by state authorities, business associates, moneylenders, and criminals. In many cases, clear stories of forced migration, but stories that in practice did not fall within the narrow definition of a refugee in international law. Most of this group had claimed asylum, yes, because they were forced migrants in one sense, but they were not refugees under international law. And indeed, some people who had moved in clearly forced circumstances had not claimed asylum because they did not believe that they would be classified as genuine refugees. In turn, nearly all of the people that we interviewed had paid smugglers to bring them to the UK. Most had sought work on arrival, and this reflects the level of choice that all had in responding to this situation. In fact, what we have here is a complex set of paths if we're looking at what moves people into irregular or illegal status in the UK, a complex set of parts that include legal and illegal entry, various things that happen to migrants when they are here, and a variety of outcomes. Or, to take another study I've been involved in conducting research in Athens in the early 1990s with refugees from Kurdish and Assyrian communities in northern Iraq, it was clear that all had experienced persecution. The Iraqi state had used chemical weapons to bomb their villages, and all would effectively fit in most people's definitions of a refugee. Yet many were unable even to apply for refugee status, as the Greek state at the time would not allow them to do so. In turn, there was an interesting difference in the situation of Kurds on the one hand and Assyrian Christians on the other. In spite of them coming from neighbouring villages and experiencing exactly the same form of persecution, the Kurds essentially were mobilising in the classic refugee sense to move back to their home country when it was possible to do so, indeed to the safe haven, so-called, that was set up by the international community. Whereas the Assyrians, as a community, had made a decision to permanently resettle away from Iraq, effectively to move their community to the US. And again, this reflected voluntary choices that these refugees were making, and a series of social, cultural, and economic motivations that went alongside their political status as refugees. I'm tempted to ask, is there anything that analytically distinguishes a migrant from a refugee? The element of force, perhaps, but as we've seen, force and voluntariness combine in the process of movement, and there are many shades of grey. The economic versus the political nature of their circumstances. And yet political refugees send remittances, work, engage in trade, whilst economic migrants also mobilise politically. Some might say the trauma that refugees experience is what distinguishes them. And yet voluntary migrants might also move in desperate circumstances. And it is clearly wrong to assume that all refugees are traumatised. One might also say that it is the legal status itself, the labelling as a refugee, that makes the difference. Although the reality around the world is that the same legal status or label can lead to vastly different rights and circumstances, with both refugees and migrants sometimes having and sometimes not having the right to work, free movement, welfare assistance, and or a pathway to integration or citizenship. However, what is objectively different between migrants and refugees is the logic for why we have a refugee status in the first place. That is, that refugees are a category of people for whom the relationship with their home state has broken down. Refugees are people who have lost the protection of their state and for whom international agreement is therefore necessary to ensure that a state will take up that protection role. This is the argument for keeping a refugee status, and indeed also the argument for not extending the status to those displaced by environmental catastrophe, or indeed those looking for a better life. It's not that refugees have a better moral claim to be allowed to live in other states. It's just that they have a specific moral claim, and without another state taking on this protection role, they would effectively be left stateless. Now I'm going to draw to a close, and in the last few minutes, I'd like to start with an observation that in some ways goes against what I've just been saying, that the association of a phenomenon with migration does not necessarily mean that migration caused it, and I think this is a big underlying difficulty for those of us working in the field of migration studies. It's an important point. It means, for example, that the association of riots in northern mill towns last year with communities of immigration does not mean that migration caused this unrest. Or the fact that the 9/11 bombers were in some senses migrants from Saudi Arabia does not mean that our response should be to slap on immigration controls. As we've seen recently, settled populations in Northern Ireland are just as capable of rioting where there are divisions in communities and perceived grievances, whilst British-born UK nationals are just as capable of bombing innocent people in London as foreign nationals and immigrants. And I'm somehow shocked that one of the major responses in the political field to the bombings of 7/7 was to start talking about immigration and our sense of Britishness. However, This is not to argue that migration, whether immigration or emigration, is irrelevant to the major public issues of the day. Far from it. And I'd like to highlight in closing three areas in which I think there is a role for public policy on migration and refugees, and for researchers to support the development of that policy. First, migration is, as I hope I've demonstrated, a major avenue through which individuals and families seek to address poverty, inequality, and violence. Even refugee camps, in which perhaps 6 million people are currently trapped in protracted situations, can be places where people start to sort out their lives, and quite a bit of the work that I've done in refugee camps has been to document the extraordinary vitality of economic life, even in desperate circumstances. In this context, we should surely not seek simply to prevent migration. Even if we accept, and I certainly do accept, that there are times when the circumstances of movement are damaging to the migrant, him or herself, and to sending and receiving communities. Rather, we should seek to allow it where we can, and adjust to it, seeking to understand the circumstances in which it becomes damaging, abusive, coercive, and dangerous. Second, we need to recognise that public policy itself has effects, and that those effects are not always benign. Most importantly, the criminalisation of certain types of migration, most worryingly of many aspects of asylum seeking, has clear negative consequences for the individuals involved, but may also be damaging for the wider society, both in origin and in destination. And we need to understand well the unintended consequences of state policy, and to use this to ensure that policy decisions are not based on false assumptions or inadequate modelling of outcomes. We in universities too can ask the questions that government does not automatically ask. For example, the current consultation on the UK government's managed migration policy, much of which I welcome, is framed rightly within an understanding of the positive consequences that immigration can have for the UK job market. But we can and should ask too, what are the potential consequences of different aspects of these proposals? The focus on a point scheme to assess skills, or the emphasis on temporary mobility for lower skilled migration, as I've mentioned. What are the consequences of those for developing countries? And here we need to move beyond the implicit assumption in the government's proposals, and indeed in much popular discourse, and frequently on the Today programme on Radio 4, that the principal consequence of migration, skilled migration for Africa, is bad because of the loss of skilled personnel. And finally, as I hope I've demonstrated, it's clear that migration presents huge opportunities too. I don't think it's an overstatement to say that sea change has occurred in government thinking on migration in the last 8 years, which can be observed elsewhere in Europe too, although this is one where public understanding still lags a long way behind. The UK government as a whole accepts the positive economic, fiscal and social consequences of migration to the UK in a way that was inconceivable a decade ago. Our work has helped, in some small way, to contribute to that. Meanwhile, the Department for International Development and a growing number of development cooperation ministries around Europe have transformed their thinking from seeing migration as an undesirable consequence of poverty and conflict, one that is damaging to poor countries, to one of a number of ways that ordinary people themselves seek to achieve development rather than waiting for the slow progress of state or corporate-led projects and investment. I don't wish for one moment to claim credit for initiating this shift, but I'm proud that our centre is now part of it, that there remain many in NGOs and other branches of government and in other parts of the world who remain deeply sceptical about migration and whose instinctive reaction is still to seek to curtail it or alternatively to remove the necessity for it. I believe that gives us plenty of scope for work in the future. Thank you.
Professor Russell Keane will call the word. When Richard asked if I would play the role of proposing this vote of thanks, he did me the honour of saying that I was one of the main reasons why he came to Sussex. Let me return that compliment by saying that 10 years ago, when he applied for the lectureship in human geography that we had at that time, I became very excited because I was absolutely convinced, just convinced, that if we appointed Richard, as of course we did, then Sussex would be making one of the very best appointments that perhaps it's ever made. When Richard applied for the job 10 years ago, aged just 30, there we are, I thought everybody how old we are. Already at that stage, after just 5 years since his DPhil, he had produced 3 books, many more have followed since. He produced a book based on his own PhD in Northern Portugal. He'd done a jointly authored book on rural development and a jointly edited book on refugees, geography and refugees. In addition to a number of articles, book chapters, he had experience already of supervising successfully PhD students. He was, I think, press officer of the Royal Geographical Society. He'd already started to raise research money. In other words, he'd achieved in 5 years what many of us seem to take almost an entire career to achieve. And that fast-track progress has, of course, been amply demonstrated since his move to Sussex, where the publications have proliferated. He has been spectacularly successful in raising research income, a superb lecturer and teacher, as we've witnessed tonight. Very good at bringing in research students and networking and facilitating people working together. And I thought it was nicely revealing how much Richard referred to the work of his colleagues during his lecture.